understand them better so that we can contribute to this whole new world that that's so essential today. Maybe we will learn something from them. At least I hope. I'm sure that we will learn something from them. Anytime we really listen carefully to people of other religions, they change us somehow. They help us see some things that we've forgotten. They help us see new things. So it's an important dialogue that goes on. So that's what we're doing this week, exploring some of the religions of the East in particular. I've taken a quick look at Hinduism. Last time we looked at Buddhism, particularly the story of Siddhartha Gautama as the paradigm or the model for the Buddhist way. The way of detachment, detaching oneself from clinging and desire in order to find true life. That is, the life of freedom. That form of Buddhism that we talked about last time, you know, and some of you were here, is what nowadays we call Theravada Buddhism, the Buddhism of South and Southeast Asia. Basically, the vision of Buddhism is that life in this cyclical notion of samsara that we talked about goes on and on and on, but it's permeated by suffering in the sense of continual frustration and anxiety and defeat and ultimately losing yourself. And the Buddha said the reason for that, the reason that we experience life that way, is because we cling, right? And so the prescription that Siddhartha Gautama gave to his disciples is to root out clinging, root out that sense of self that causes us to grab hold of everything and try to keep it while it constantly slips away. Last time we noticed that behind that vision of life, of course, is the notion that everything is impermanent, right? There's nothing that's permanent. Everything is constantly changing, in flux, and therefore, when we try to hold on to it, inevitably, we're going to lose it, and losing it is suffering. So Siddhartha Gautama set forth a whole way of life called the Eightfold Path, in which he prescribed disciplines and practices, especially meditation, insight meditation, so that people can follow this path, detach themselves from the sense of self, and reach the state of nirvana, which is a state of perfect freedom. And we noticed last time that there are provision for different types of people on the path. There are monks and nuns who are following the path at the highest levels, reaching nirvana, and then there are the lay people who are following, let's say, the five precepts, particularly the ideal of compassion and loving kindness, the first precept, not harming any life, not harming any living thing, on the contrary, showing loving kindness and compassion. And there's a very noble or very moving meditation on loving kindness and compassion that lay people commonly use, which basically just starts with sort of filling yourself up with lovingness and compassion, and then creating sort of an aura around yourself of loving kindness and compassion so that the hostile vibrations from other people just bounce off, right? And instead you return loving kindness and compassion. And then finally that little meditation ends with giving this to other people, thinking of all your own loved ones far away and near, and all of the peoples of the earth, and all living beings above and beneath, and filling them all with love and kindness and compassion. And that's the kind of meditation that that a Buddhist-like person might do every morning. So there's many stages on the path for Buddhism. Now, that form of Buddhism that we talked about is most characteristic of what we call Theravada Buddhism, the path of the elders, the kind that is still practiced today in Sri Lanka and in Southeast Asia, Cambodia, Burma, Thailand, and so forth. What I want to talk about tonight is another form of Buddhism. Buddhism takes a lot of different forms. But the other main school or movement that arose in Buddhism is called Mahayana, which means something like the greater vehicle. The greater vehicle in the sense that it is more encompassing. It includes more people. It doesn't make such a distinction between monks and nuns and lay people. In fact, it has an idea of universal salvation, if we want to put it that way. And this arose in India, and then it moved up into Central Asia, to China, to Korea, to Japan, to Tibet, Vietnam, Mongolia. So this is the East Asian form of Buddhism. Most characteristically, we find it in China and Korea and Japan. It's a very important form of Buddhism, and this is what I want to share with you a little bit this evening, to give you some little window into Mahayana Buddhism, as you will come to understand it, particularly from your Chinese and Japanese and Korean and Vietnamese friends. And Tibet, okay. What is this new vision? Probably most characteristic of the new ideas that began to surface in this form of Buddhism is to take that notion of compassion, which last time I defined for you as the feeling that all living beings are fellow beings in the ocean of life, right? I and you are together in the ocean of life, and thus what affects you affects me, right? That notion of compassion, and making it into the ideal practice, the ideal goal for all of us to follow. Embodied especially in the figure that is called the Bodhisattva. The Buddha in the making, or on the way of becoming a Buddha. This is the ideal for Mahayana Buddhism, not just to follow the Eightfold Path and reach Nirvana, but to reach the stage of Nirvana, but then voluntarily to continue to exist for the sake of helping all other living beings. Right? Kind of totally dedicating yourself to compassion. Now, of course, the bodhisattva represents a very high ideal. There are some bodhisattvas who live in the heavens, some who live, you know, in human form. Some of you might be bodhisattvas. Then some choose to live in the hells to help the living beings suffering in the hells. But according to this form of Buddhism, all of us should really take the first step of becoming a bodhisattva. I mean, a lot of us aren't there yet. But that's the ideal, to fill yourself with compassion that you live for others. You root out, you know, that sense of selfishness, and you dedicate your life to this larger reality. Another very important teaching that developed in Mahayana is what I'm going to focus on this evening, and that is the three dimensions of Buddha, because I think this is where we can get into some very good comparisons and contrasts with Christianity. Of course, we can also with the Bodhisattva, right? The many Buddhists have pointed out that Jesus Christ is a Bodhisattva. You know, we can talk about that a little bit. You know, how we see that as fitting, but. The Mahayana Buddhists also expanded the notion of what the Buddha is. And this then becomes sort of the basis for the Japanese, Korean, and Chinese forms of Buddhism. They start with, of course, the human Buddha, the human form of the Buddha, which is, in our particular world age, Siddhartha Gautama, just like the Theravada Buddha Buddhism teaches. That's the great teacher. That's the human being who reached enlightenment and taught us all the way. Of course, there have been many human Buddhas. The Lotus Sutra says there have been 300 trillion Buddhas living in all of the 300 trillion worlds. That's a vast notion of this whole universe. So there are a lot of human Buddhas. But then, in addition to the human Buddhas, there are heavenly Buddhas. Buddhas who have reached Buddhahood and then have created heavenly Buddha realms, where they preside and can help, reach out and help living beings who worship them and call upon them and so forth. These are like gods and saviors, right? Heavenly Buddhas. And then underlying all of that, the human Buddhas and the heavenly Buddhas, is the universal Buddha nature. Of the Dharmakaya, the universal Buddha reality that somehow or other forms the basis and permeates everything. Everything is somehow or other participant in the universal Buddha nature. You notice that this kind of brings us back to a notion of ultimate reality, right? Last time we talked about how Siddhartha Gautama had refused to deal with questions about some kind of ultimate reality and then simply taught his path as a very practical matter of, you know, rooting out your clinging and reaching nirvana. But in Mahayana Buddhism, because of various developments and influences, one of the most important ideas that developed is this notion of the universal Buddhahood, that everybody and everything participates in. There's other ways of saying it. This is where the whole notion of the void or emptiness comes in. If some of you have studied a little bit of Buddhist philosophy, that, you know, underlying all reality is a very creative, compassionate emptiness, right? The silence that is behind all sounds, the stillness that is behind all movement, and so forth. And that is the universal Buddha nature. And we all have it. You are the Buddha, I am the Buddha, these flowers are the Buddha, the trees are the Buddha, the mountains, and everything. Okay? Now, this is partly why this form of Buddhism is called Mahayana, because it's a much broader and fantastic conception of reality as Buddhahood. But what this does is to open up possibilities of following the path in many different ways, right? You can follow the path based upon the teachings of Siddhartha Gautama, which would be very similar then to Theravada Buddhism. You can worship heavenly Buddhas and receive help from them. Or you can sit down and meditate and realize your own Buddha nature. Now, while you think about that for just a moment, let me just show you a couple of pictures to give you a visual image of Buddhism while you're thinking about this notion of Buddhahood, and you might have a question or two. These are not all terribly important pictures, but I think it's important just to have something visually in front of your eyes so that I'm not just talking theoretically, but, you know, there are real people. This happens to be in Beijing at a Buddhist temple, a very important Buddhist temple there in Beijing, and this is in Kowloon. The reason I brought this particular slide along is that this is an attempt in this Buddhist temple in Kowloon to represent the universal Buddhahood by having so many Buddhas there that you can't count them. It's called the Hall of the 10,000 Buddhas. They're all up here and they're just all around the temple. I'm sure there's more than 10,000, I think. It's a fantastic idea of simply, you know, the whole universe is filled with Buddha. And these are all, you know, different forms and expressions of Buddhahood. This is one of my favorite Buddha statues. Actually, this is the future Buddha, Maitreya, carved in way back in 8th century Japan. Very exquisite expression of Buddhahood. And then there are the bodhisattvas. Bodhisattvas are all over too. This happens to be representations of Kanon, the bodhisattva of great mercy. And there are 1,001 of those in this temple. Wherever you look, there is Kanon, who reaches out and helps anyone who needs it. There's a funny Buddha. This is in Hangzhou in China. Rock carving on the wall, on a mountain cliff that's been there for centuries. The Laughing Buddha. And I threw that in just to indicate to you that there are many, many different forms of the Buddha, expressing all different kinds of ideas and feelings. And one aspect of Buddhahood is to be jolly. And then there is a Tibetan mandala with the cosmic Buddha in the center of the whole cosmos, and then surrounded by Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and so forth. Let's stop for a moment with this particular picture. And let me tell you a little bit about this form of Buddhism. It's one of the forms of Mahayana Buddhism that sometimes we call Tantric Buddhism or Vajrayana or Mantrayana. It's also called Esoteric Buddhism. It looks pretty esoteric. But this is a good illustration of notions of Mahayana. This is Tibetan Buddhism, basically. And there's also a school in Japan, Shingon. The basic idea is that the whole universe is the body of the great Sun Buddha, Mahavairocana, and that's who that is in the center. The whole universe is somehow or other the expression or the manifestation of the great Sun Buddha. And then all of these other Buddhas and Bodhisattvas sort of derive from the great Sun Buddha and provide you sort of a map of the whole universe. This is similar to this that mandalas are pictured, these cosmograms, maps of the whole universe, illustrating the Buddha nature of everything. Now what this form of Buddhism does is to suggest that we human beings are microcosms of this great cosmic Buddha reality. And we can realize our Buddhahood by various ways of tuning into or plugging into this cosmic Buddha. They talk about the three mysteries, the three basic sacred mysteries of thinking, speech or sound, and actions. The great cosmic Buddha, there is a cosmic Buddha thinking, a cosmic Buddha speaking, a cosmic Buddha action, going on constantly. And it is possible for us then, by special disciplines and rituals of thinking and speaking and acting, to plug into that, so that my thinking becomes tuned into the thinking of the great cosmic Buddha. And then I realize my Buddhahood that way. So that's what mandalas are for, to assist us in thinking. Also various forms of meditation help us plug into that thinking of the cosmic Buddha. For speech, there are the mantras, these sacred formulas and sounds that can be repeated, like Om Mani Padme Hum and so forth. And then for acting, there are the ritual gestures. If you've ever seen movies of Tibetan monks, they're constantly moving their hands in various forms of mudras or gestures. Would one of you turn the projector off for a second? Turn the lights back on. Any questions so far?
On the other side.
These different representations of the Buddha, mm-hmm. are they representations of one Buddha? Like we would have many different paintings of Christ that mm-hmm. emphasize different aspects of Jesus, mm-hmm. of the Christ, or are they representative of different Buddhas?
Well, they're different Buddhas. A lot of them are heavenly Buddhas, and there are many, many heavenly Buddhas.
So the laughing Buddha and the Japanese, that very elegant Japanese Buddha, mm-hmm. are not representing the same
Buddha. No. The very elegant one is Miroku, or Maitreya, the future Buddha.
Okay.
Which, actually, I shouldn't say it, because the laughing Buddha is a derivation from that. But then there is Amida Buddha, whom I want to talk about, especially tonight. There's the great Sun Buddha, who really is a heavenly Buddha that has been sort of elevated to universal Buddhahood. And there, the different statues and carvings and whatnot of the Buddha express different qualities, and usually they are different Buddhas. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Could you explain the difference between the Bodhisattva and the Buddha, like Siddhartha? Is he a bodhisattva, or is
he? Well, Theravada Buddhists do call Siddhartha a bodhisattva, or they called him that. They call him that before he reached Buddhahood, because bodhisattva means becoming a Buddha. But in Mahayana, Siddhartha Gautama is not spoken of particularly as a bodhisattva. A bodhisattva is one who ages and ages ago has took a vow to practice the disciplines of Buddhism, root out all desire and clinging, reach Buddhahood, but then, rather than simply passing into nirvana and leaving the samsara cycle, voluntarily re-entering the cycle, voluntarily being reborn again, and again and again and again, but now solely for the purpose of helping other living beings. Right, that's what a bodhisattva is, and that's intended as the highest goal for us to look to. Mm-hmm. Now, a Buddha, I suppose, in Mahayana Buddhism, the heavenly Buddhas are, in a sense, bodhisattvas who have simply reached very, very high perfections and levels, and have created heavens or Buddha realms, and usually there are lots of bodhisattvas in those Buddha realms. Okay. Any other questions?
You had said Christ was considered one of the human Buddhas, or what was he considered?
The Mahayana Buddhists would speak of him as a bodhisattva.
So then would they embrace Christianity as just another, they would embrace Christianity as part of their...
Well, a lot of them highly respect Jesus Christ and the stories of his rooting out all of his sense of self and sacrificing himself for, you know, to give life to others. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Dan.
This is a really mundane question, but since I run in the realm of imagination and curiosity, I'll ask it. I've always noticed, or I've noticed that so many of these, of the Buddhists that are represented, are quite heavy. You don't see that as an ideal in other, in other religious cultures.
Yeah,
is there any significance to the weight other than the jolliness or whatever that may provide?
Well, yeah. Mahayana Buddhism, in particular, is a very life-affirming form of Buddhism because of its basic notion of the universal Buddhahood. If we could draw a diagram again of samsara up here, which I don't want to take the time to do, in one conception of Buddhism, nirvana is different from this samsara cycle that we live in, right? By reaching nirvana, you won't be born again, and you reach the state of nirvana. But in the Mahayana Buddhist conception, ultimately, this samsara existence that we all live in is Buddhahood. Right? There's a formula that says samsara is nirvana. Because of the fact that the Buddha nature is universal, there really is no need to leave samsara and escape from it in order to realize Buddhahood, because Buddhahood is right here. So, if Buddhahood is in food, then you will have a fat Buddha, or whatever. I mean, it expresses a positive outlook on life, is what I'm getting at. Not all Buddha statues are large, like this Midoku here was a very slender statue, but you're right, many of them are fairly husky and
when
robust.
When you think about the emptying of passions and all of those kinds of things. It just seems kind of odd to me that they have a weight problem. But that's okay. That's my culture.
Yes.
Do you see any connection of the three dimensions of the Buddha with the Trinity?
Well, people have often pointed that out. I don't believe too much in making those kinds of cross-cultural comparisons. I think this fits very well in Buddhist philosophy, but it doesn't particularly well fit Christian philosophy. For one thing, this human dimension of the Buddha, that's actually called a nirmanya, or what's a good word for it? It's a magic body. It's not a real human. It is an expression of Buddhahood on the human level as an apparition to lead and guide people, right?
Could be like the logos, the word?
Well, the idea of the logos or the word, I suppose, could be a little bit more equated with that universal notion of Buddhahood. There is a universal logos which enlightens everyone. No, I mean, you could make all kinds of comparisons, but I don't find the Trinity comparison particularly helpful, because it asks the wrong questions. You know, then you're going to try to find the Father, Son, Holy Spirit, or something like that. You're in, it's a different conception. Other questions?
Do they have the same status? I mean, are at the same level, or do they, in the temple, do they?
These?
Yeah. Well, any of them.
Well, in the temple, you will mostly find representations of various heavenly Buddhas and Bodhisattvas.
But they don't share the same temple.
Oh, yeah, sure they do. You will find lots of different Buddhas statues and Bodhisattva statues right in the same temple. Usually the temple will be dedicated to one, and that will occupy the major or the center space.
The Buddha alone has 300, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember whether they're different
or not. Yeah, there are a lot of different ones, and they represent different aspects of Buddhahood.
But they're different level.
A couple more questions, and we will move on.
Yep. Are all Buddhas portrayed as male?
No, but mostly. Theoretically, there's no reason that there aren't female Buddhas. But the tradition arose in Buddhism, in the different cultures, that somehow or other, to become a Buddha, you first become male. So there was even a lot of discussion, but I think the point of view won out that women eventually will be reborn as male in order to reach Buddhahood. Now that was disagreed with, but that was kind of the dominant position. Now, on the bodhisattva side, there are a lot of female bodhisattvas. In fact, a very interesting switch took place with probably the best known of all bodhisattvas, Avalokiteshvara in India, the bodhisattva celebrated in the Lotus Sutra, who hears everybody's cries for help and reaches out and saves everybody. As Buddhism moved into China and Japan, Avalokiteshvara became female. Well, in India, Avalokiteshvara was male. Or you could say that he or she is beyond gender, but usually portrayed as female in China and Japan. That was a kanon that we showed up here before.
Yep, do they have strong family relationships and religious practices in the family?
In Buddhism? In Buddhism? Yes. Certainly. Although there's always been one major problem, especially in China, the fact that the highest path in Buddhism is to become a monk or a nun means abandoning your family or leaving your family, right? And the Chinese didn't like that very much. But Mahayana Buddhism overcame that in various ways by making lay people and monks and nuns not really separate. So yeah, the family is very important in Buddhism. Now, what I want to do, let's move on, and then we can come back to some questions, is to pick up two forms of Mahayana Buddhism that are probably the best known, or at least the most influential in both China earlier and today in Japan, and that would be what we call Pure Land and, of course, Zen, or Chan in China. Now, these aren't the only forms of Mahayana Buddhism. There are many others that are perhaps more philosophical. There is that Tibetan form that we talked about a little bit when I had that slide up there. But these two forms, the Pure Land form and the Zen form, developed first in China and then were brought over to Japan as sort of as reformations and simplifications of Buddhism. For people who were searching for the truth but not able to fully comprehend and practice the more elaborate forms of Buddhism, like the Tibetan form. So these two are forms that focus very directly on one simple practice. One of them, the Pure Land Buddhist forms, focuses on a heavenly Buddha. And Zen focuses on the universal Buddha nature. And these have become very important both in China and Japan. So let's talk about them just, you know, rather briefly, just a quick introduction. Starting with Pure Land Buddhism, I guess, because it perhaps is the easiest to explain. Pure Land Buddhism is a school or a sect of Buddhism that started in India. Let this stay on here too long. But then became important in China and in Japan, together with the notion that the world is degenerating and everything is getting ready. This is an old Buddhist doctrine that you know, you start with a very perfected form of Buddhism and then it degenerates. Well, people in China and Japan were saying, well, we're living in the degenerate age, so we need something simple. And thus came a focus on the great Buddha Amida. A heavenly Buddha, but one who is particularly important because this is a Buddha who millions of years ago was a monk who took 48 vows about reaching Buddhahood, and then once Buddhahood was reached, he would create a special Buddha land that he would make available to everyone who called upon him, particularly for those who couldn't help themselves. And this is the Buddha who dedicated himself to sinners, right? To those who really had no merit, who couldn't follow the Buddhist disciplines and reach nirvana on their own. They can call on Amida Buddha, and Amida Buddha, with a great storehouse of merit, would make that merit available to them so that when they die, they would be reborn in his Buddha realm, which is called the Pure Land. The Western Paradise. And the Pure Land scriptures give glowing descriptions of the Pure Land. It's a land of, you know, just of heavenly music and no pain and suffering whatsoever. Beautiful birds are constantly singing. The bottoms of the ponds are coated with gold dust. And, you know, whatever you can think of, there it is. Moreover, those who are reborn in the Pure Land will never again be reborn back here at lower levels. That's not yet nirvana, but you know, it's a lot closer than most of us are now. Now, this form of Buddhism had great appeal, particularly to the masses, but also to many people living in China and Japan in the the 6th, 7th, 8th centuries, a little bit later in Japan, when there was great upheaval in society. You know, it looked like the world was coming to an end, and people reached out for this form of Buddhism. Now, maybe I've made it sound too simple, It is very simple to plug into Amida Buddha. You have faith in Amida Buddha's vows, you know, a heart filled with faith, and based on that faith, you call out the name of Amida Buddha many times, using a little formula, Namu Amida Butsu, praise be to Amida Buddha. Now, the theology behind that, and there is a well-worked-out theology, many masters of Pure Land worked on this, but finally it was Shinran in Japan in the 13th century who really worked it out into a complete theology. The theology behind this looks to Amida as the great compassionate power of the whole universe, as the result of his vows and his becoming Buddha. And he sends out a radiant light that permeates the whole universe and penetrates into our hearts. Right, there is the light of Amida Buddha that is everywhere and right in our hearts. And then all of the other Buddhas are constantly repeating the name of Amida Buddha, so that Amida Buddha's name is also constantly reverberating through the universe. According to Shinran, when we have faith in Amida Buddha, it's not something that we do. It's something that Amida Buddha has already given to us by this universal light and this universal sound which is sent out. Now, the reason that is emphasized is the Pure Land theologians felt very strongly that the only way one can be saved in this degenerate age is by relying on the power of the Buddha. That they called other power. In contrast to the more standard forms of Buddhism, going back to Siddhartha Gautama and most of the other schools, which put a strong emphasis on self-power. And they came up with words for it. The Japanese, of course, is tariki, other power, and jiriki, self-power. And the Pure Land theologians, like Shinran, were absolutely convinced that in this degenerate day and age, nobody can reach enlightenment and Buddhahood by self-power. Nobody has self-power. Nobody has merit or any ability to practice these disciplines and reach the goal. Therefore, the only hope that we have in this day and age is relying on Amida Buddha or other power. Shinran was so convinced of that he did something unheard of in Buddhism. He got married. Going way back to Siddhartha Gautama, part of following the path at the highest level was to become a monk or a nun. And strict celibacy was part of the discipline of rooting out all clinging. Well, Shinran said, it's no use. In this day and age, we can't do it by ourselves. And therefore, since we have to rely totally on Amida Buddha, I might as well get married. So he got married and had a family. Started actually the tradition in Japan of a married clergy in Buddhism. Let me mention a saying of his that would maybe sum up pretty well this theology of Pure Land Buddhism. One of his teachers had made a statement like this: Amida Buddha is so compassionate and powerful that he can save even the most despicable sinner. How much more he can save you people. You know, sounds like a good sermon. God is so merciful, he can save even that person lying in the gutter, so surely he can save you. Well, what Shinran did was just to flip-flop that around. Can you imagine how he said it? Anybody? How would you flip-flop that around to be in keeping with a total other power theology? A puzzle? It's actually it's pretty good Christian, pretty good Lutheran theology.
Saved by grace alone?
Well, that's what this is, saved by grace alone through faith. But how would you change that saying? Amida Buddha is so compassionate he can save even
a sinful person, how much more can save you? One of the parables that was studied was the Pharisee and the publican in the temple. What Chinran said was, Amida Buddha is so compassionate, he can even save you people. How much easier it is for him to save that drunk lying in the gutter or something like that. And of course, I mean, it's the obvious meaning of it is that as long as we think that we have something to contribute, some self-power, some merit on our own, we're not going to rely entirely on Amida Buddha. And so it's more difficult for him to save us. While the person who realizes that he or she has no merit and no self-power will turn completely, rely on Amida Buddha's grace, and will be saved. So that's one form of Mahayana Buddhism that is very widespread today. I've oversimplified it. It has much more than that. There are many Japanese in particular and Koreans who belong to Pure Land Buddhism. In most of our large cities, there are Pure Land Buddhist temples, like in Chicago. And you know, they do a lot of teaching. They have worship services. But their main focus is calling on the name of Amida Buddha, with this kind of theology of grace. Now, it might be worth remembering this, so we can talk a little bit about comparisons with Christianity. I think there are some very obvious ones. But before we do that, let me move over to Zen Buddhism, which, as you might have guessed, delights in putting emphasis on total self-talk. The Zen masters, starting in China and then in Japan, would say, you don't need to rely on Amida Buddha. You don't need to think about going to the Pure Land. You are Buddha. This is the Pure Land. So the total emphasis then changes based upon this notion that there is a universal Buddhahood that we all participate in and which is available to all of us. But what Zen Buddhism does, basically, the word means meditation, and it reaches back to Siddhartha Gautama and teaches that his form of meditation, just sitting down and meditating and opening your mind to the truth, is the only practice that's necessary. Just like for the Pure Land Buddhists, the only practice that's necessary is worshiping Amida Buddha. For Zen Buddhists, the idea is the only really necessary practice is meditation. And the whole goal of meditation is the realization of your Buddha nature. And the Zen masters taught everyone has the Buddha nature. There's no class differences here, rich and poor, educated and ignorant, men and women. We all equally have the Buddha nature, and it's just a matter then of following the discipline, sitting down and meditating, practicing zazen, to come in touch with that Buddha nature. That Buddha nature is Amida Buddha. It is the Pure Land. So, you know, you don't need to think of that as something far away. It's right here. Now, according to the Zen masters, our biggest human problem is not that we live in a degenerate age, which is what the Pure Land people felt. Our biggest problem is the blocks that we put in our minds so that we don't see our Buddha nature, right? The mind blocks. Going back to, you know, the idea of ignorance that Siddhartha Gautama taught as the basis of our problems. You know, we're ignorant of who we really are. We have the tendency to cover up and to put barriers so that we don't really see the Buddha nature that is present, you know, in all things and in ourselves. We construct a what they call a secondary reality in our mind. Ideas that we create, and then we act as if those ideas are real. Like, for example, good and evil. Right? Now or maybe that's a little loaded morally. How about pleasure and pain? Or like and dislike, maybe like and dislike. I like this person, I dislike this person. Now, is that reality? I mean, it is reality for us, but it is a reality that we have constructed.
Right? I have constructed that reality in my mind, and therefore I never experience either person for what they really are. I have that preconceived notion that this is likable and this is dislikable. You know, or if, you know, if it's raining and cold outside and you're sitting in this room, you construct an idea in your mind that is, you don't like that, right? And then you go outside and of course you're not going to like it because you have already constructed that in your mind. So you never experience what they call the thusness of reality, which is actually another word for the Buddha nature, or the real core of reality. You never experience that, but instead you're constantly just experiencing your mind blocks, right? And you know, we can go on and give many, many other examples, but we are, you know, again running short on time, so let's leave it at that, and I think you kind of know what I mean. And therefore, what the Zen masters teach is the solution is to empty your mind. Right? That's the key in Zen Buddhism. And then the Zen type of meditation. And in this way, it's a little bit different from Siddhartha Gautama's type. The goal is to just let your mind empty itself. And we, you know, we could give a little demonstration of that and have you sit a little bit while and see if you can empty your mind. I think you'll find it's very difficult to do, right? You think you're emptying it, but constantly new thoughts are coming in. The Zen people say your mind is like a monkey that's constantly jumping about from tree branch to tree branch. And you've got this thought for a little while, and then you've got that thought, and another thought. I like this, I don't like that, I want this, I don't want that. What's going to happen tomorrow? I'm sorry about what happened yesterday. You know, all of these thoughts are going around in your mind so that you never really experience the thusness of life, right? So the whole function then of Zen meditation is to sit down quietly. A big emphasis is put on posture, you know, sitting in the right way, beginning to observe your breathing, and letting your thoughts go. Not trying to control them, but just letting them go. Becoming kind of like a detached observer. You know, you're sitting in a lotus posture and your knees start to hurt. You just kind of sit back and observe that. Oh, my knee is hurting. Or maybe not even that. A knee is hurting, right? And then surprisingly, that thought leaves. You know, and then you hear a bird outside. Oh, there's a bird noise. And then that thought goes. So you just kind of observe it, and in that way begin to let these thoughts go. And of course there's a rigorous discipline involved in the Zen practice, and this, you know, is an extended practice, months and years. But the goal is finally to reach the point where you can totally empty your mind and thus be totally receptive to the reality that is there. I think I better just maybe stop at that point and give you all a chance to react to both forms of Buddhism, ask some questions, or maybe best of all, start thinking about these in terms of our Christian attitudes. I mean, can we learn anything from these forms of Buddhism? Are there similarities with Christianity? Are there strong differences and contrasts? So, what would you like to bring up, ask, comment on?
Do you practice meditation?
I practice meditation, yeah.
The Zen type?
Yeah, I find the Zen type a very good type of meditation. We might ask that question if you want to follow that up. Why is it that a lot of Christians, particularly Catholic Christians, I know a lot of Jesuits, for example, who practice meditation. What is it that some Christians find helpful about that kind of meditation? Well, that would be one question you might think about.
Well, when Christians meditate, they don't use the Buddhist mantra. They use, don't they convert it to a Christian thought or mantra? For example, yourself.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, but I think in the Zen form of meditation, you don't need a mantra. There are other Buddhist forms of meditation which do concentrate on something. And there, you know.
Like even a thought?
Yeah.
When you say something.
Well, you can start out with a thought, but the technique in Zen meditation is not to try and latch onto any thought. Mm-hmm. You let all thoughts go.
Well, if all thoughts can go, it's to get in touch with that inner voice, that
yeah,
silent
that inner
voice of the spirit. And mm-hmm. in doing so, you could be essentially taught, well, St. Paul meditated. So
yeah.
Did,
well, I'm glad you mentioned
so did, So
what did Saint, do you remember St. Paul's saying, which Zen masters like to quote?
Well, you might even say that the speaking of tongues was a type of meditation, mm-hmm. not being afraid of what that is. But mm-hmm. the speaking in tongues is something we don't understand, but yet it is a communion with the spirit.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
the spirit, therefore, works on the heart of a man, working on the mind of a man, to
mm-hmm.
really teach the
mm-hmm.
the heart of God.
Right.
And in so doing, Paul perhaps received most of his revelation.
Yeah, he received a lot of insight, didn't he? Revelation.
Mm-hmm.
And the one saying that came to mind when you mentioned St. Paul was his statement that it is no longer I who live,
but
Christ lives
in me.
If Christ lives in me, and I kind of open myself up to that, get rid of all this garbage going on in my mind all the time. We shouldn't call it garbage because it's necessary. I mean, you've got to make plans for tomorrow or you're going to miss the boat or whatever. But you put it in its proper perspective and practice meditation, and what you get in touch with is that inner reality, which St. Paul said is Christ, right? So I think that's the approach that many Christians take when they practice this type of meditation.
On Monday when we met, we kind of summed it up at the end that, and you brought it up at the beginning today, that we're going to, as we look at this week, we're going to think in terms of how we can hear from other people
mm-hmm.
instead of always as the Christians are so busy doing.
Mm-hmm.
And isn't this the difference between prayer and meditation? Is when we are praying, again, we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
We're doing it with our mind, with
mm-hmm.
words
mm-hmm.
formed in our mind.
Mm-hmm.
We're doing
right.
the talking.
Mm-hmm.
And in
mm-hmm.
meditation, this is an opportunity for us to hear the Spirit.
Right. That's very good. And in some ways, then, prayer fits this model somewhat better. Although meditation is practiced here too, and you know there is prayer, meditation, and so forth, but prayer is focused on that divine figure, right, Christ or Amida, while meditation is more the receptive part of it. Yeah, that's good. Other thoughts or comments?
Well, why is it thought in some cases that it's actually that meditation is bad? I mean, gotten that from more from most Christians perhaps
mm-hmm.
is that fear you're opening your mind to things that are maybe Buddhist or something
yeah.
that are negative
mm-hmm.
to them.
Yeah, could be.
Those things that I've heard in the past about.
Well, I think that there are different reactions to meditation. I know the papal office sent out some instructions to some of these priests and others who were practicing meditation, you know, you better watch out, that's dangerous stuff, and so forth. I think part of it is not understanding it, and part of it is maybe there are Christians who, you know, take this, you know, and run with it and practice it in the total Buddhist context, and then other Christians think that may not be compatible with Christian practice. Now, meditation is certainly a Christian practice. You know, as you mentioned, St. Paul meditated and Christ meditated, and you know, there's a long tradition of Christian spirituality of meditation. St. John of the Cross, Meister Eckhart, the Jesus Prayer. You know, there's all kinds of Christian tradition of getting in touch with that inner reality, which is Christ. But I think the reaction against it comes from these Eastern forms of meditation, whether it's transcendental meditation or yogic meditation or Buddhist meditation. And the fact that they are that they have grown up in another religion.
Is this the same thing, this relaxation phenomenon and self-hypnosis, is that meditation?
You can call it that, I suppose, if you want. I don't know much about self-hypnosis, but relaxation techniques sometimes take the form of meditation, like in transcendental meditation, that is basically kind of a relaxation technique. That's not really what Buddhist meditation is all about.
Well, that meant the other meditation is relaxation business. Mm-hmm. I don't know about religion, but I'll tell you, it works in sports.
Okay. Some people find that, that Zen meditation works too. Is it the Zen of tennis playing? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what is the Lutheran Church? Can we take time to tell us what the Lutheran Church believes about this right now? The meditation. It's sort of a do-it-yourself religion? No.
I don't know. People are Lutherans. I don't speak for the Lutheran Church.
No, I didn't mean to say that.
Let's kind of remember what we're trying to do here. We're listening to these voices that maybe we haven't listened to very much. And the first goal is to begin to understand them, or to make a step toward understanding them. It's not to say that this is all right, or this is all wrong, or really not. We're not trying to pass judgment on it now, but just listen to it. But then the second question is a more evaluative one. Maybe can we learn something from it? Maybe we can't. And certainly the goal is, for most of us, is not to become Buddhist. I don't really believe people shift that readily from one religion to another. Buddhism is a totally different religion, and if we wanted to go down the line and point out many, many ways in which it differs from the Christian worldview, we could do that. And yet, by dividing things up that way, maybe we're making a mistake. Maybe the way we think that we have envisioned the world needs a little bit of reconsideration. And if we listen to somebody speaking from this other vision over here, that might be an impetus for us to take another look. Do we have meditation in Christianity? Well, yeah, we do. We forgot it, but we do have it, And, this notion of a universal Christ that is in me, or the universal Logos, yeah, that's in Christianity. Maybe we forgot that we have that, but now in listening to the Buddhist, we are reminded of it. So that would be, one at least one level of learning something from them.
One passage in the Bible that kind of reminds me about this meditation that Jesus criticized the priests and the Pharisees of his time that go in public and pray aloud, and he tell people that people should go to their room and shut the door
and not make a public show.
And even be quiet because God in a way knows what is. Mm-hmm. And is that for me some kind of meditation?
The quiethood part of it, right?
Yeah, part of it.
The idea that there doesn't always have to be talking going on.
Yeah, but it's some kind of meditation that you can even find in the Bible, though. That you can see
right.
That it's part of Christianity.
What about the other form? I think we've focused pretty much on meditation, but there is this other form of Buddhism.
What I wanted to ask, they have many forms of Buddhist, and I know when I was in China, I saw a lot. But one of the things is there are certain Buddhists that have that represent a certain type of work, and they would go into something like predestination, that you choose by when you were born and during that time, that this is going to be your destiny. Now, how does that go into that?
Certainly part of the Buddhist worldview is the notion of cycles of life, that notion. They don't operate with the notion that there's one lifetime and that's it, but there are many lifetimes. One lifetime causes the next lifetime. So, in that sense, we are choosing in this lifetime what we will be in our next lifetime. And that's part of the Buddhist thinking. Thus, the exhortation is to get busy in this lifetime and root out the clinging and the desire and so forth the wrong sense of self, lest that clinging and that desire drag you down to a lower rebirth in your next existence. Yeah, that's part of the Buddhist worldview. It's obviously not part of the Christian worldview, right? At least in the way most Christians conceive of it. Yeah, but, you know, then we could say, well, is there something we can learn from it? And I'll bet there is.
We have to understand what it is.
Mm-hmm. There's a strong emphasis on volition, right? All of us will all kinds of things, you know, something.